bison and tiquis all passed on.
Now, I see that that says big game in the Austin colony. Are you going to tell us a little bit about what that means in a minute?
We're going to get into the Austin colony a little bit later on.
Okay.
After those animals were gone, the paleo Indians that lived in this area probably hunted stuff like deer, antelope, bison, smaller game, certainly. One of the problems that these settlers in this, that the early Indians in this area faced is there's no rocks in this part of Texas. I mean, if you come to a place like Brazos Bend and you find a rock, it's because it was hauled in.
Why do I care whether there's a rock?
Well, that was really important when it came to making stuff like arrowheads.
Oh.
I mean, without a rock, you couldn't make something
right.
like this.
It's probably not just any old kind of rock. There probably had to be a certain kind of rock.
That's right. These are all made out of flint because they're nice and hard, and they make nice sharp edges. These tips were found at Brazos Bend State Park, but they didn't come from there originally. The Indians in that area might have traded with Indians from Central Texas or either from North Texas in order to get enough stone to make these.
So they became pretty valuable.
Very valuable. I mean, especially a point like that. I mean, that's a work of art almost.
All right. I'm going to cut in on you just for a second because I've got to say hello to the Project Wild folks that are watching in Maryland. Gwen, Michelle, Donna, I'm glad you're here. Glad to see you. Or I hope you're seeing us.
Yeah, I hope so.
Welcome aboard. Okay, go ahead.
That's all right. So one of the adaptations that the Indians made in this point, in this area, is to use fish scales. And these, believe it or not, are scales off of a fish called a gar. And they just lay in place.
I know y'all can't see this, but it's too small. So we have these tiny scales from the fish.
It's a large fish, up to 6 or 8 feet long sometimes. And the Indians found that if they killed a gar and took the scales off it, they could use these as arrowheads. I mean, they're already pre-sharpened practically. They could attach this to the end of an arrow. And from one gar, they might have, hundreds of these little arrow points.
Right. That would be something small or some small game animal that they would
use. Oh, certainly.
At.
Certainly. But, where it may take, several days to make a point like that, kill a fish and you'd have hundreds of these.
Yeah. Okay. So tell us about the next slide. We're looking at a tribal distribution of Indians, and specifically David's talking about the Karankawas.
Yeah, the part of the state that Brazos Bend is in was inhabited originally by Karankawa Indians. And they range pretty much from Galveston Bay south to around the Corpus Christi area.
Do we know anything about that name? What Karankawa means?
The Spanish people said that it translated into dog lover. Now, we know that the Karankawas kept a lot of dogs. We don't know if they were dog lovers because they like to eat dogs or because they like to keep dogs. But one way or the other, they were probably dog lovers.
Okay.
We don't know a whole lot about the Karankawa Indians. We do have a dictionary of about 400 Karankawa words, which I believe will be on the internet here if it's not already.
Okay.
From what we know about in the Menton, Karankawa Indians seem to be very large, up to 6 feet tall in most cases. The women, on the other hand, seem to be very short. And nobody can quite explain this. There's some theories behind that when they went out hunting, the men got most of the good food and the women were stuck with the leftovers.
Huh.
So the men grew very healthy and the women kind of...
And very angry.
Very angry. I would imagine very angry.
We want to say hello to Madrid. Got somebody listening in to us from Madrid. That's pretty cool.
Right.
All right.
The Karankawa Indians lived in bands of probably 50 to 100 Indians for each one. Most little bands had two chiefs. They had a chief that was in charge in wartime and a chief that was in charge in peacetime. And depending on the circumstances, the appropriate chief would rule the group there. The Indians lived in small little huts. They weren't teepee-using Indians like we think of with the Plains Indians. They lived in huts called box, B-A-A-K. And the way they would make these is they'd take a long willow branch and they'd stick one end in the ground over here and bring it up and stick the other end in the ground over here.
Okay.
Then they'd get another one and stick it in the ground and come over the top and stick it in the ground over here. And they might have 10 or 12 of these. So basically they make like a little dome. And in the wintertime they'd cover this with deer skin or buffalo hide. In the summertime, they pick the leaves off the palmetto plant, and that's what this is. And this one's a little bit torn up, but they take these, and they could stack it like that, and then put another one on top, and another one on top. So it'd be just like a shingle, and that would keep the rain off of their house. Plus, it allowed them to break their camp down and move to a new location pretty quickly. They mostly traveled in small canoes. They would hollow out a cypress log or a cedar log, and make a canoe usually just big enough for the man and his wife and maybe one or two children. But they used these together to move around in. Now the Karankawas were hunter-gatherers moving from place to place, you know, looking for game. They probably hunted a lot of buffalo as they swung through here on the southern migration. They certainly hunted deer, supposed to have hunted alligators, and lived off quite a bit of seafood.
All right.
Yeah, big clam and oyster eaters they were.
Well, I understand the hunter part. Tell me a little bit about what gatherer means.
Gatherers just mean going out and collecting food. Mostly the men's job was to go out and do the hunting, and the women did the gathering. And that probably entailed picking nuts, berries, roots from different plants, possibly harvesting the wild rice that grows here in the park. So as they were out picking the vegetation while the men were out getting the meat, basically.
It sounds like then that the women must have known a lot about the plants. How would they have been able to know the difference between poisonous plants that were used for medicine or, you know, plants that were used for eating? Or
Of course they had to be intimately knowledgeable about the plants and the earth to survive on the land like that. A lot of that was probably passed down through the years. And it probably originally just started out through trial and error.
Right.
They found what was good and what was healthy and what didn't make them get sick. And as they passed it down from generation to generation, that's what they kept living on. But they had to live with the land. And they discovered, you know, certain plants that are medicinal, certain plants that are edible. And some of the plants that they found that were medicinal, we still use today. The marriage ceremony among the Kronkwe Indians, they didn't have any formal ceremony when a husband and wife wanted to get married. They just moved in together. And for 6 months after they moved in together, they took all their food and gave it to their wife's parents.
Wait a minute. The couple moved in together, and then they gave all their food away to her parents.
All the food to her parents.
Okay.
And her parents would give some food back as they saw fit.
Ooh, so maybe if the parents didn't like the son-in-law, things wouldn't be good.
You might lose the wife there. Another interesting twist to that is that the other rule was that for 6 months, the husband couldn't look at the wife of the parents.
Ooh.
Which, maybe there's some good things to be said for that.
You better watch out. You're going to be in trouble.
The Kronkwe Indians seemed to care very much for their children. When their children were born, they gave them two names. They gave them a magical name and then a common name. And everybody used the common name. The parents were the only ones to know the magical name. It's not exactly known what the purpose of this was, but every child had two names to go by. If we scroll on down a little bit.
Let me just tell them a little bit. If you really like that tribal distribution, that's part of the Parks and Wildlife website that we have on Texas Indians, and so I would encourage you after the field trip to go there because there's a lot of really great information about Texas Indians there. Now go ahead and scroll on down. Dave is telling us about the Kronkwes.
Well, the Kronkwes lived... Kronkwes were left pretty much alone until about 1528. There was a Spanish explorer named Cabeza de Vaca, and he was sailing along looking for the mouth of the Mississippi. And he overshot the mouth of the Mississippi by several hundred miles and shipwrecked on Galveston Island.
Oops.
Yeah, not very good navigator, I suppose. A lot of what we know about the Kronkwe Indians we found out from Cabeza de Vaca, because he kept a pretty good journal. There's some misunderstanding whether or not he was captured or whether or not he lived with the Kronkwes of his own free will. There's kind of mixed reports right there.
Is there any descendants, Kronkwe Indian descendants, that are in the area anymore?
No, the Kronkwe Indians are all gone, and we'll touch on that a little bit in just a second here. We know towards the end that they did recognize de Vaca as kind of a medicine man. In fact, he's attributed to doing the first surgical operation in North America.
Really?
By removing an arrowhead from a Kronkwe Indian.
So that's what that's what we see at the bottom of page 2 is Cabeza de Vaca removing an arrowhead.
De Vaca eventually escaped from the Kronkwe Indians, or left the Kronkwe Indians, as the case may be, and went back to Mexico. For the next 150 years or so, the Kronkwe Indians had numerous fights with the French settlers, with the Anglo settlers, with the Spanish settlers. 150 years later, by 1820 or 1840, the Kronkwe Indians were all gone. I mean, with the combination of gunpowder and European diseases coming in, we had completely wiped them out.
So why was there so much fighting? What was happening that made the Indians go to war so often?
Well, here's this huge, vast land of Texas that nobody had claim to. So the French settlers were coming in and trying to make claim to it. The Spanish settlers were doing the same. The Anglo settlers were doing the same. Last thing they wanted was Indians hanging out on it, basically.
Oh, okay.
So if they can get rid of the Indians, they felt like they had a better claim to it. If we click on to page 3 now, and we'll give you a minute for that to come up.
you're just joining us, this is David Heineke. He's a park ranger or park naturalist at Brazos Bend State Park, and he's giving a little bit of history about Brazos Bend State Park. What you should see at the top of the page is a picture of Moses Austin.
Yes, this is when the Anglo history comes into Brazos Bend. In about 1819, Texas was part of Spain. A man named Moses Austin decided he wanted to try to bring settlers in from the United States and settle into Texas. So he got permission from the Spanish government to bring a number of families in. Spain was in a bit of a turmoil at that time because Mexico was trying to get her independence. So what happened in 1921 is Moses Austin dies, and if you scroll on down, you can see a picture of his son, Stephen F. Austin.
I wanted to just say to you that someone is asking us again, do Indians still live there? Can you answer that real quick?
No, they sure don't. The Karankawa tribe is completely wiped out. They were probably wiped out in 1840, long before most of the other tribes.
So as far as we know, there weren't any other Indian tribes that were in that area?
There were some that certainly passed through there. We probably had a few waves of Apaches or Tonkawas or maybe even Comanches come through that area, but probably not settle in that area. It's basically not a very hospitable area to live in if you're an Indian. Fresh water can be at a shortage sometimes if you're along the coast. The mosquitoes are just terrible. In fact, the Karankawa Indians used to take alligator fat and smear it over their bodies to keep the mosquitoes down.
Ooh, so even way back when, they had trouble with mosquitoes.
Trouble with mosquitoes. the early Anglo settlers said that worked out real well because they could smell the Karankawa Indians from a mile away.
Oops.
So they couldn't sneak up on them.
Yeah.
But back to Stephen F. Austin here. About the time his father, Moses Austin, dies, Mexico gets her independence from Spain. And Stephen F. Austin is trying to work out a deal with the Mexican government to bring some families in and settle in Texas. He's hoping that he can make some money off this, basically.
Right.
If we scroll on down to the map there of Texas, this is the way Texas used to be. It used to be what is now Texas. You take in part of New Mexico, part of Colorado, on up even a little corner of Wyoming.
And we think we're big now.
That's right. We used to be a lot bigger. We used to be a whole lot bigger.
All right. Tell us what happened.
Stephen F. Austin requires permission to bring 300 families in and settle them between the Brazos and the Colorado rivers.
And who is he getting this permission from?
From the Mexican government at this
point.
Each family that comes in is going to get about 4,500 acres.
Wow.
For the grand total price of $250.
That's a pretty good deal.
That's a pretty good deal. Too bad that's not around nowadays.
But $250 back then probably is still a lot of money.
I'm sure there's a lot of people that couldn't afford that then. Some people came in by wagon, similar to the one we see here. Most of the people came in by ship. They came on from steamboats from New Orleans along the coast and into Galveston, or south of Galveston.
So they would load up, these families coming would load up their wagon and their livestock too?
They would load up everything that they had. This was, you know, they were heading out, starting a whole new life, basically.
Wow.
In an uncharted land for the most part. Part of the problem with the Austin settlement comes in with the story of the Lively. And the Lively was the ship that Austin had got to carry the first bunch of settlers from New Orleans over to his new settlement. Well, in those days, there was some confusion about the Brazos River and the Colorado River. On some of the old maps, they were actually mixed up. So Stephen F. Austin had it all set up where the Lively would leave New Orleans and he would meet him at the mouth of the Colorado River. But the Lively came through and stopped at the mouth of the Brazos River, thinking it was the Colorado. Well, Colorado in Spanish means colored. If you look at the Brazos River, it's very red. It's colored.
I've heard that it's called the Chocolate River. Is that true?
It does get kind of chocolate brown colored sometimes. So anyway, the settlers land at the mouth of the Brazos River and there's no Austin there to meet them. And it's January and it's cold and they're hungry. So they get tired of waiting for Austin and decide to head on up the Brazos River. So they sailed up the Brazos River right past where Brazos Bend is today and up to a place where there was a big bend on the Brazos River and built a fort there. That's where Fort Bend County gets its name from. And that's where the park is today, is in Fort Bend County. All in all, Austin brought about 1,000 families to Texas. For his efforts on that, he wound up making no money at all. He did wind up with several thousand acres of prime farming estate for himself. But he lived in a very modest home, as you can see there, on the lower Brazos River. Okay, I think we can go ahead and flick to our next page here.
Click on number 4. We'll see if it comes up. Oh, yes, it's going to come up. This like we've lost our connection here. But we'll go ahead.
Okay. Problems started when there got to be too many Anglos coming and settling in Texas. This made Mexico very nervous. In order to get land in Texas, what you had to do is you had to join the Catholic Church, vow your allegiance to the Catholic Church and to the Mexican government. And Mexico even sent people up through Texas occasionally to check that people were carrying through with this promise. As there got to be more and more Anglos through there, Mexico felt like they were losing power. So they started taxing the people more. They started putting more restrictions on them. Uh-oh. And the Texas people didn't like this too much. I mean, most of these Texas settlers that were coming in were pretty free-willed people. That's why they came here in the first place. So enter General Antonio Lopez de Santa Anna.
And that's somebody we're familiar with.
Yes, commander of the Mexican army. He came in to try to calm down the Texas people with force. And that didn't fly too well. In 1835, he went to Gonzales to try to take a cannon back, and the people of Gonzales wouldn't give it to him. He finally wound up burning the town, which then followed into the massacre of Goliad, the seizing of San Antonio, and eventually the fall of the Alamo. And I don't want to go into too much detail on that kind of stuff, but this started what's called the Runaway Scrape. And hopefully most of you are familiar with the Runaway Scrape, or at least have heard of it.
I bet if there's fourth graders out there listening, they are studying Texas history right now.
Well, for those of you that aren't too much, what the Runaway Scrape basically was a series of battles. As the Mexican army was sweeping across Texas, they were chasing the Texas army led by Sam Houston right in front of it. They had several little battles, but Sam Houston always seemed to keep one step ahead of him. Sam Houston took a lot of heat for this because they thought he was chickening out the whole time.
Uh-oh.
But optimists think that Sam had a plan the whole way. This was probably a typical Mexican battalion here at the beginning of a battle. A few weeks on the road and they wouldn't look nearly that nice, I'm sure. What finally happened is Santa Ana caught up with Sam Houston at San Jacinto in April of 1836 and was quickly defeated, as you know. Had he not been defeated, I guess we'd be sitting here doing this in Spanish, huh?
I guess so.
Santa Ana was captured and taken to Velasco and agreed to give Texas her independence. First, if you scroll on down, you'll see the first capital of Texas.
There. Doesn't look nearly as fancy as our capital now.
Not quite as impressive. This capital was actually only the capital for about 9 months.
Oh. Okay.
It was in a town called of West Columbia, which is just a few miles south of the park.
And was this specially built to be the capital of Texas, or was it someone's home?
I believe it was an existing building, and they made it into the capital. So Texas is the only state in the United States that was actually a separate country for a period.
Woo-hoo.
That's right.
We're our own country.
We were only in our own country for about 10 years, but we didn't make it that long anyway.
Wow. Okay.
The Republic of Texas had a lot of problems, though. I mean, we were a new country, and we didn't have much money. We had problems with the Mexicans on the south wanting to take more land back. There were lots of battles down there as to where the South Texas border was. We thought it was the Rio Grande. They thought it was the Nueces River. Oh. So there were a lot of battles in there. A lot of Indian problems. More settlers from the United States coming in than Texas could handle at that time. And we were having trouble with trade, too. So the Republic of Texas never was really going that well. If you'll click on to 5,
we'll wait for just a second. This is David Heineke. He's telling us a little bit about the history of Brazos Bend. Catherine, can you get Nancy to come over? Go ahead, David.
The original area where Brazos Bend is now was originally deeded to a man named Abner Harris and William Barrett. And these were two of Austin's colonies, which means that this part of the state were probably the oldest one of the oldest Anglo settlements in Texas. By 1845, Texas had joined the United States, and this area was owned by a man named Mills. And Mills was one of the big-time cotton brokers. They grew cotton, probably sugar cane, some other grains on the park site. They also held a number of slaves. We're not exactly sure how much. We see some evidence of this and some land changes there. Also, right behind the visitor center, there's a big thing called a brick cistern. And it looks like a big dome that comes out of the ground, and I think you'll see it on one of your slides there.
Yeah, if you scroll down to the next picture, I'm going to ask you a question about that plantation before we talk about the sister.
Okay.
Is that a certain person's plantation, or is that just what a typical plantation would have looked like? Or?
This is actually a plantation in the town of West Columbia, south of us a little bit.
Okay.
This was a fairly fancy plantation for this area, and many of them would have been a lot more modest than this. There's not an original plantation house left at the site of Brazos Bend, but there were probably at least one big home there. At the site where the cistern was, we know that there used to be a home.
Oh, okay.
What a cistern is if you think of a great big thermos bottle buried up to about its neck.
Mm-hmm.
It was a place to store water. It didn't let water in from the ground like the well, but the gutter system off the house probably drained water into the cistern. Or in times of low rain, the slaves could go down and haul water out of the creek and dump it into the cistern.
And so they would just drink water untreated like we do today.
That's right. One of the values of the cistern was that you could dump the water in there, and most of the impurities, anyway, would settle down to the bottom. So they could lower a bucket out and pull it out. And it even, to some extent, worked as a very crude refrigerator. If they had some butter or some milk or some meat they wanted to keep a little bit cooler, they could put it on a rope and lower it down in the cistern. And with all this water down there, it would keep it a little bit cooler. If we scroll on down a little bit, I think we'll see a picture of a steamship there. The Brazos River in the early days was a big commercial center. I mean, there was a major trade route to all the cotton farming that goes on in the Brazos. There were steamboats constantly running up and down the Brazos. I don't know for a fact that this is a steamboat from the Brazos, but this would have been typical.
There's even pictures of alligators.
That's what makes me think maybe there's the Brazos.
Maybe
who knows? We think at one time there was probably a riverboat landing at Brazos Bend there.
We have someone wants to say hello to Megan and Lauren from Houston, Texas. We're enjoying the field trip and we can hear it. The information and concept is great. So we're glad that you're listening on. Thank you.
Okay, we'll go on to number 6 now. Get up into a little bit more modern history. In the early 1900s, a family named Hale bought the land. And they were some land developers, well, not land developers, big land holders, I guess I should say, from Houston. This is a picture of them. Notice this is another picture of them sitting on the cistern right here at the top.
What year did you say you thought that was probably taken?
This picture here was probably in the 50s, or probably in the 50s, this top one. This next picture down dates back a little bit older. These next two pictures with the house in there are probably from the 30s. What the Hales used this land for is they did some cattle grazing on it. They harvested some pecans on it. They did some small-scale farming on it. And obviously they did a lot of waterfowl hunting.
Yeah. It looks like to me that that's an awful lot of ducks or geese or whatever. Was that before we had hunting regulations?
Yeah, just in case there's any game wardens out there watching, these were probably before the game regulations. You can see the H&H on the top of that house, and that stands for Herman Hale. And that was the original.
He was pretty proud of his house.
Yes, he was proud of his ducks too, wasn't he?
So they owned all of the property, the 5,000 acres that is Brazos Bend State Park.
That's correct. And they, over time, they did several land changes there. Built several buildings, created some lakes. Here you see a picture of them going through the marsh here. Most of these plants that they're going through there are probably wild rice.
Do they just use regular boats? David's looking at the picture where they're going through the marsh with their boats. Are those just regular?
Probably regular flat-bottom boats. If you go into the next picture, you can see the people in the wagon. One of the things they used the ranch for was entertaining. They had lots of big Sunday afternoon socials out there. Ladies in their church clothes and men in their church suits coming out and having a picnic and taking horse-drawn wagon rides around the park. So it really was almost as much of a weekend getaway place as it was a farm or a ranch.
So did they still keep a place in Houston? Did they have another house in Houston?
They had another house in Houston and several houses out here, actually.
Wow.
This next picture with the three guys with the duck. The man on the left there is named Frank Hoot, and he was a ranch foreman there for the Hales. When the Hales finally sold the land to Parks and Wildlife, Frank Hoot stayed on there and was the first park ranger at Brazos Bend. Once he retired from park rangers, he joined our volunteer organization there and continued to come out and contribute to the park. And was just a wealth of knowledge about the flora and fauna and even the history of the park.
Okay.
The man on the far right there is Herman Hale, the original owner of the park. I think if we go down to the next page.
Well, here's a good question for you, David. Someone wants to know if you have any archaeological sites at Brazos Bend State Park.
Yes, we do. We have 15 archaeological sites. 10 of those are prehistoric sites, date back to the Indian times. Certainly the cistern that we saw would be a historical site, because it does date back to probably the 1840s, maybe the 1850s. We have found some places where the Karankawa Indians had inhabited in the park, and those are considered archaeological sites.
So tell me a little bit about the sensitivity of archaeological sites, and for instance, what should we do if we found an arrowhead at the park?
If you find any kind of archaeological significant site, what you want to do is just leave it alone.
But the temptation is
I know, you could pick up an arrowhead like this, and it's a neat souvenir, but that's all it is once it's in your pocket. Just by the way this is laying and the way other things are laying around it, trained archaeologists can come in and kind of put together the puzzle of what happened here, who lived here, even how long ago they lived there.
So you could do a better thing by leaving it and telling someone about it than actually putting it in your pocket and taking it home. It would
Absolutely.
Be more important to you that way.
Absolutely. Some of the other things that people find occasionally at the park are these little, what look like little flat rocks. And these are actually what are called pottery shards. The Karankawa Indians made a lot of pots, and they used the mud from the Brazos River and Big Creek and make it into these pots.
How would you know that this is pottery?
It looks a lot.
Versus anything else.
It looks a lot like a flat rock, but if you look at it on end, you can see it's got a perfect curve to
it.
So if you can imagine a couple of hundred of these put together, it'd make a pot.
It has some etchings.
This one has some little etchings on it, some lines. This one here actually has a little hole through it. They might have put a leather strap through there and had a little pot for carrying water or berries or something like that in. These are other archaeological finds that are from the park.
And why do you have them?
These are all stuff that people have brought in and turned in tonight.
You still would have liked it better if they'd have left it there and told you about
Absolutely.
It.
Absolutely. Then we could get our archaeologists in there and take a look at it and see, you know, if it should be removed. They can record all the data that needs to be recorded. I'm grateful that the people did turn them in, at least.
Right.
But if you find something like that, you know, not only in Brazos Bend, but in any state park, that's the property of the state of Texas, and it needs to stay where it's at.
Right. Okay. Thank you.
Here you can see on the top picture on the history of Brazos Bend, you can see the cistern again.
We're on the last page now of the history of Brazos Bend. David Heineke is telling us about the former hunting lodge.
Yeah, but this time the cistern has a building behind it, and this is a hunting lodge that the Hales built. They built this probably in the late 50s, early 60s. By the way, this is our present-day visitor center. The state came in and
so that building is still there then, that's what we see.
Yeah, that's right. It doesn't look much like that, but the building is still there. It's still the original building. The Hales, if you scroll down to the next picture, the Hales had a big clubhouse there. And this was the clubhouse that they did most of the entertaining in.
Is that building still there?
No, nothing's left of this building. It was in really poor shape when the state came in. Some of the changes that the Hale family did is they impounded several lakes and created several new lakes. This next picture is of Elm Lake when it was first formed. It's a fairly shallow, about 120-acre lake. And this was right after they impounded it. The Hales did let the Boy Scouts come out and use the land for a while. This is on one of the Oxbow Lakes with Troop 669, I believe it was, out of Houston that came out and used to use the Hale Ranch.
Can scouts still come to the park?
Oh, yes. We have huge, huge numbers of scouts that come out. They don't have as much freedom as those scouts there did, but yes, we get huge numbers of scouts and always welcome them.
That's neat. What kind of things would they do if they came to the park?
Oh, they do a lot of hiking, a lot of biking. We work with them quite a bit to get merit badge programs. When they need to meet certain criteria, we'll arrange to have programs for them, whether it's hikes about trees or animal tracks or just general nature hikes. So we work fairly closely with the scouts.
Do they ever do like service projects where they help y'all build things or?
Get a lot of service hours from them. Lots of Eagle Scout projects too.
Oh.
I think in the last 2 years they've built 11 of these wooden boardwalks for us.
Oh wow!
So that works both ways. If we help out the scouts, it comes back to us, and they help us out with the park. They also do a lot of trail maintenance for us, going around and trimming trees, keeping the base of trees clean from from plants in the picnic areas and low limbs, keeping those trimmed up.
Donna was telling me earlier that it's quite invigorating and rewarding to just smack around and cut vegetation. She said that's one of her favorite things to do with this park.
Take out your aggression sometimes that way, and your frustration. This last picture was the big ranch house at the park, and this was the old Grandfather Hale's house that he built there. And